What happens when everything you've built your life upon suddenly feels foreign? When I stepped off the plane in Oxford at 22, I carried more than suitcases. I carried 3 decades of Sunday school answers, a pastor father's certainty, and the comfortable weight of never having questioned whether God existed. Oxford, with its ancient spires and empty church pews, would strip all of that away. This wasn't the dramatic crisis you see in movies. It was quieter, colder, like watching ice cubes melt in your hands while you desperately try to hold them tighter. Imagine growing up so immersed in church that you literally played jail under communion tables while your father preached. My childhood wasn't punctuated by church, it was constructed from it. Saturday nights ended early for Sunday services. Spring breaks meant church ski trips. Summers belonged to church camp. The octagonal building on Fredericksburg Road with its blue cushioned pews wasn't just where we worshiped. It was my neighborhood, my social world, my identity. When people talk about owning your faith, I genuinely didn't understand. How do you own your last name more than you already do? How do you separate yourself from something that grew inside you like roots anchoring you to holy ground? This is the peculiar challenge of the pastor's kid, the lifelong churchgoer, the person for whom faith and identity are so tangled that pulling one thread threatens to unravel everything. For anyone raised in a faith tradition, there comes a moment when you must ask, would I believe this if I hadn't been taught to? That question terrified me. But sometimes terror is just transformation wearing an unfamiliar face. The River Thames witnessed months of my desperate prayers and confusion. I'd imagined instant friendships at St. Aldate's Anglican Church, warm welcomes and easy belonging. Instead, I faced awkward silences, cultural barriers, and humiliation after falling off my bicycle while trying to look effortlessly British, mocked by local children. I couldn't decode dinner parties or understand social cues. My Americanness became something to hide. For months, I walked Oxford streets alone, seeking comfort in ancient stone walls. But as C.S. Lewis knew, buildings make terrible friends. The breakthrough came when I stopped trying to de-Americanize myself and invited my heathen classmates, Sophie, Ben, Mac, over for curry and chestnuts. That night, sharing chocolate in my living room, I felt like myself again. Sometimes accepting our foreignness rather than fighting it opens the door to genuine connection. The distance between isolation and belonging isn't measured in miles, but in moments of vulnerability when we stop performing and start being present. At Oxford, friends dismissed religion with polite condescension. I laughed along at Christianity jokes while something inside withered. Unlike high school doubts where God felt distant, here I questioned whether he existed at all. The doubt was physical, seeping into my bones like cold numbness. Cycling home one night, I suddenly felt what a godless existence would be like. That darkness terrified me. Then there was Jisoo, Austrian by nationality, Korean by blood, with faith deeper and less anxious than mine. When a thief stole my bike's front light battery, he offered to ride ahead at night. I'll be your front light. In my spiritual darkness, he became exactly that, not through apologetics or prayer, but through presence. Sometimes we need someone who has been in the dark before, showing us the way forward simply by being there, proving faith can survive questions without pretending they don't exist. Ben came to Christmas Eve service with me, so I attended the Oxford Atheist Society meeting with him. A thoughtful atheist who'd been a devoted Christian from 16 to 18, Ben defied my inherited boxes. He showed me kindness, laughed at my jokes, and was the only school friend who came to church when invited, wanting to hear In the Bleak Midwinter, his favorite hymn. His journey, both to and away from faith, challenged my assumptions about faith failures. I cornered an apologetic student at a party, desperately questioning him. He invited me to hear John Lennox, the renowned Oxford mathematician and apologist. Lennox's arguments comforted me less through logic than through example. Here was someone brilliant who had asked my questions and found answers. At a freezing Christianity and art conference in London, nursing a terrible hangover, I heard Dr. Gavin McGrath say something that changed everything. the Christian artist's job is to tell the truth. He referenced Psalm 137, where exiled Israelites refused to perform sacred songs for their captors. "If I forget you, O Jerusalem," the phrase haunted me. Around this time, I was writing my thesis on Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things, a devastating novel about forbidden love in India's caste system. Valutha, an untouchable, falls in love with Amu, a divorced woman from a higher caste, violating the love laws that dictate who should be loved and how much. I began seeing Valutha as a Christ figure, an innocent man killed by those threatened by his radical vision of equality. Roy wasn't Christian, yet she'd written one of the most compelling gospel portrayals I'd encountered. If truth exists in art, regardless of its creator's faith, then God's presence isn't limited to explicitly Christian works. I'd been searching for God in church, but found him in heathen novels. English gardens changed everything for me. Unlike manicured American lawns, they were glorious chaos, bushes poking through fences, overlapping flowers, vines spilling everywhere, beautiful and free. The women I met embodied the same freedom. They wore whatever they wanted, ate real food without diet talk, and cycled to parties in the rain with natural ease. I watched them with desperate thirst. My turning point came at a church meeting over banoffee pie, condensed milk, banana, toffee, whipped cream, chocolate. Despite my internal restrictions, I ate the entire slice. When I finished, something profound happened. I was okay. No panic, no guilt, no compulsion to run 6 miles. The self-control I'd been so proud of had been melting away, and that was healing. By year's end, my restaurant mindset shifted from what would be least damaging to what sounds best right now. Sometimes freedom comes through embracing beautiful chaos. Jisoo and I existed between friendship and something more. Almost kisses, late-night kebab trucks, bike rides with headlamps. One day in London started well with croissants and galleries, but at the Tate Modern, my mood shifted. Art museums felt romantic, meant for holding hands, not distant friendship. By the Thames, we had the clumsy conversation. "Is it okay to not be sure?" I asked. The river seemed to pause, offering a moment to kiss or declare something deeper, but when nothing happened, it rippled on. I've spent too much time dwelling on these moments, wondering what might have happened if I'd said yes instead of expressing uncertainty. But rivers don't flow backward. What's done is done. Years later, running past Nashville's replica Parthenon, I watch light reflect off water and seep through trees in a way that makes me turn my head. The consciousness itself is the gift, not just the light and water, but my awareness of their beauty. Some questions never get answered. The unanswered moments, the almosts, they shape us as profoundly as the certainties we cling to. Oxford's Martyrs Memorial Tower is 73 feet, honoring 3 Protestant reformers burned at the stake. I cycled past it countless times without noticing. Around the corner on Broad Street lies a humbler memorial, white and slate bricks forming a cross embedded in the pavement, marking where Cranmer, Ridley, and Latimer actually died. People walk right over it. The distance between these memorials is just 0.1 mile, but my spiritual journey between them took a year. One August day by the river, my friend Eric shared his dread of returning home to complicated family dynamics. I grew uncomfortable with this vulnerability, preferring Eric as a caricature rather than someone with real problems. I stayed reserved, offering only, "I'm sorry," without mentioning Jesus or hope. Unlike the martyrs, I didn't speak boldly in Oxford. But I realized that being my authentic self was its own evangelism. The crooked, winding path, filled with detours and uncomfortable silences, wasn't a bad way, but perhaps the only way. Sometimes the most honest thing we can offer is our genuine, doubting, beautifully imperfect presence.